Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist, 29th of September, so it's from actually a last week or more than a week ago, and the cover story is Inky Code, we thought they left no writing, we were wrong. I think we did think they left writing, I think sort of interpreting their strings. So basically the Incas had a South American civilization based along Peru, going down to mid-Chile up to Ecuador, to that area, and they were a sort of socialist, moneyless, wheelless, beast burdenless state with great ability to work stones and various things like that. They had a socialist system in which so the people would be bred for the state. They were brought up in a pit for the first 2 years of life, so you wouldn't form attachment to your mother, and then you would work, and then if you reached, I think, 55, which is a grand old age, you wouldn't have to work again. Everything would be provided for you as a grand Inca, and they had a system of roads, which is pretty incredible, and runners with very good memories who would convey fairly complex messages by running. But they also had a system of writing involving twine. Now, the twines had different colours, different textures, different knot types, and these were on a sort of like a bangles, charms, you know, hundreds of them together. And they would sort of like be an innate memoir for an oral tradition, and this would be used in their system of accounting and taxing, because the entire socialist state required people to pay dues on time. And I think if you did something wrong, you went over the Andes to the coca plantations on the other side of the Andes in the Amazon. And it's a fairly tragic story. So I've read about it. And so the Inca string writing, so these are basically things that you'd recognize as a piece of string to tie up a parcel. I'd have these dangled at various lengths. And I do remember reading a graduate student, honors student, was given a project and he cracked it by working out that it was a form of spreadsheet. I really don't know where that's the best way to go about it, but we'll see what they have to say. So let's look at the editorials, and of course I'm reading this fresh, so I hope you find it interesting. Universal truth contested. Mathematicians don't like to argue, but maybe they should. It's a truism that science is not true. It's just interesting after Parmenides looking at what he said. A scientific theory is merely our best guess at truth, backed up by evidence, waiting to be overturned by something better. I wouldn't say that's our, a scientific theory is a system of consistent explanations which attribute to it a cache, a cultural cache of terminologies and definitions to allow unambiguous communication. That would be my definition of a theory. So it's a system of explanations. So you have a theory of evolution and different grades of that theory of evolution. You've got the natural selection evolution, you've got Lamarckians, they're different theories within that explanation set. And so within your explanation set you have different terminologies. But I don't know whether they're asking whether they believe it's true. A theory is less usable. So you can have a sophisticated theory for a sophisticated detailed situation, or you can have a general theory. Copernicus over Ptolemy, that's the, he believed in a sun-centered universe, so, whereas Ptolemy had a geocentric universe. I think eventually with crystal spheres what are they called? Oh, bloody hell, this is what I'm doing here. It's called E-something or other. Epicenter. Yeah, Epispheres. No, something along those lines. Really interesting, because the actual center of the sphere is displaced from the orbit, and is the orbits are displaced from the center of the Earth to get it to work. Epicycles, that's what it's called. There you go. Now, I wonder what epi is. So, epi. I'm trying to work out what that means. Einstein picked holes in Newton. Darwin overturned the pre-existing stories of our origins. Oh, that's a very poor... If you know about Lamarck and the catastrophists and the various things. But mathematics is different. Theorems proved by ancient Greeks remain true as ever. Well, no. I think mathematics, having read a book about mathematics, it's given a set of... postulates. What's the maximum number of theorems you can get out of a set of postulates? I think that's what it is. Okay, Pythagorean theorem about three sides of right angle triangles. It works. Always work and won't be improved. Which is really interesting about Parmenides, about the type of knowledge which is immovable. It is Platonic ideal of truth. Another Greek, of course. Oh, God. But two incidents this week demonstrate that truth is sometimes out of reach in the mathematics world as too. And I think this is understandable. I think it was Goethe, Escher, Gödel. There's a person who, again, memory, who proved that no group of truths, the set of truths, is incomplete. Okay. On Monday, eminent UK mathematician Marco Attaglia presented a claim proof of Riemann's hypothesis. This is, Riemann's hypothesis is about the frequency of primes following a particular logarithmic power. One of the most difficult open problems in mathematics. Attaglia is certain he's cracked it. Mathematicians disagree, but decline to say in public for fear of embarrassing him. The proof was only a brief sketch, so At the very least, will require a lot of fleshing out. Brevity is not the problem with this second contested proof in the spotlight this week. So the Riemann's hypothesis is about the frequency of primes. Now, I suppose what's more interesting is, you know, what is the actual truth behind the proof? It's interesting. In 2012, Shinichi Mochizuri claimed the solution of the ABC conjecture, another long-lasting puzzle. In a 500-page paper so dense that his peers have argued that ever since, over whatever it is, or whether it is correct, until now few could commit public confrontations. Mathematicians are generally a genteel lot, so a dual controversy is a rare occurrence that surely merits statistical investigation. Well, they weren't, because was it Tycho Brahe had a... Tycho Brahe had a duel in which he lost his nose over maths, and what is it? The quantum astrologer, is it, that's his name? I don't know why they put it here. I've forgotten his name, but they used to have duels and fights over it and public things. Barring a divine oracle to hand down judgment, proof can only be found true if a majority of mathematicians define it sufficiently rigorous. Perhaps we need more to stick their heads above the parapet. That's a weird way of saying proof. If proof is either true or incorrect, it's not another... this stupid article. Okay, first steps. This is the second, smaller thing. Some might call it a miracle, but it relies on technology. At two separate clinics, three people paralyzed to the waist down have walked again thanks to an electrical stimulation implant combined with intensive exercise and rehabilitation. Can I bloody well say this rehabilitation gig is just it's like trying to cross. There's been certain deserts in Australia I've crossed and it just doesn't go, and you look up and you at a hundredth of the way across and you've been walking. It's a frame desert. So rehabilitation's like that. It's just no no let up. You like you improve just a few percent a week or a month. It's just horrendous. It is true that prevailing medical wisdom says this should be impossible because these people's injuries have ruptured the spinal cord. Contact between the brain and the nerves operating the leg muscles was thought to be entirely severed. Controversially, the researchers who restored mobility believe that some weak connections survive. By tuning the electrical device, they say it's possible to reinforce the weak signals to a point where the leg muscles begin to respond again to signals from the brain. Resulting steps are halting and awkward, but they are steps, and with them come hopes that other people could benefit. Perhaps, and need not mean paralysis for life. If you could pin down the science and work out how to identify similarly surviving spinal connections are challenging in itself, we might help many people with similar life-changing injuries. Well, what I could say is bucko. Big thing, I don't know if it's something, this is real high-profile stuff. I think there's just so many other... Look, I think it's interesting, but... I think it's sort of we've got a cinemographic bias to certain types of injuries which we can imagine ourselves. We can sort of imagine ourselves death, that's overall. We've sort of trained to if someone dies it's okay, if it's in pain it's okay, but the thought of someone struggling day in, day out trying to walk is a real hard gig. First asteroid rovers land. There's a picture of this sort of like taken by a 3-year-old at a car, but it's obviously an asteroid outside, and it's pretty, I don't know, awe-inspiring. Can you imagine actually sitting on an asteroid and, you know, be reasonably big, perhaps? You'd be lucky if it's a kilometre across, the size of a football field. That's it. So you walk over to the edge of the football field and you walk over the edge and there's a football field underneath them. The world's first rovers to land on an asteroid have arrived. And they're sending back postcards from Ryugu, the Japanese aerospace exploration agency Hayabusa. Two spacecraft arrived on the asteroid in June, and on 27th of September it dropped a pair of landers onto the surface. The landers, collectively known as Minerva 2, don't drive around the surface like standard rovers. Instead, they hop a few meters at a time, which is made easy by Ryugu's weak gravity. Hayabusa 2 and its landers have taken some impressive pictures as it neared Ryugu to drop the rovers from 60 meters up and snapped one image of its shadow on the surface, which I suppose is there, you can't really see it. Just after the rovers separated from the parent spacecraft, one of them snapped the picture as it fell, where Ryugu's surface and a bright smudge of sunlight reflecting off the camera lenses can be seen. Okay. However, the most important image was taken after the rovers landed, see left. It's blurry because the rover was rotating through the air, or space, I suppose, as it snapped the shot, proof that they had begun hopping. The image is taken by Minerva 2-1 during the hop, allowed me to relax as a dream of many years came true, said Hayabusa 2 spokesperson Takashi Kubota in a statement. Both the mothership and the rovers will continue to send images back as the mission goes on. Hayabusa 2 has two more landers to deploy. Eventually, researchers hope that images and samples from this mission will help us learn about how the planets in our solar system were born. It is really interesting. I was just going to say that when I was a kid, part of the US agreement with Australia was to give us moon maps. Okay? Moon maps. So all these fairly thick books of the original Apollo moon maps I had in my room. And it was really interesting to go through those initial moon maps because the library was throwing them out. The world's hardest maths proof. The big spat in maths is heating up again. In 2012, Shinichi Mizuki, this person really had nothing to say in the article, of Kyoto University in Japan produced a 560-page proof. Okay. Oh. Well. We've got inflation. 60 pages have just jumped in as I turn over the page. A long-standing problem called the ABC congestion, which concerns a fundamental property of numbers. But nobody can understand it, so the jury is still out on whether it's correct. Peter Scholes, the University of Bonn, who in August was awarded the Fields Medal for the highest honor in math, and Jacob Stix of Goethe University, Frankfurt, spent a week studying the proof with Mizuki in Tokyo in March. They claim to have found an error in his work. We can claim the conclusion that there is no proof. They said in a report released on the 22nd of September. The pair's reputation means their claim will be a blow to Mizuki, but there's still room for dispute. Schultz and Stix haven't spent enough time studying the proof, says Ivan Frensley of the University of Nottingham. Oh dear. Florence causes devastation. So this is the cyclone from a while back. I don't know, they call it a hurricane. Hurricane. More than a week after Hurricane Florence hit the US, the record-breaking amount of rain has dumped, still causing destruction. While most flooding is now receding, the lower reaches of some rivers in the Carolinas continue to flood, as stream that fell inland makes its way to the downriver. In places, floodwaters carries pollution from the pig slurry lagoons and coal ash dumps. Go United States! You know what, and it'll be a disaster, and you'll see these films. The full scale of the disaster won't be clear for many weeks, but initial estimates that it cost up to $50 billion. More than 40 people have died, and the evacuations and rescues continue. Many of those who stayed in their homes despite the evacuation orders have said they did so because they couldn't afford to evacuate. Go US Social Security. The disaster was made worse by global warming, as they would always say. They have to have a science aspect to it, you know. The article, and according to the First Street Foundation, a non-profit environmental organization, the 30-centimeter rise in the local sea level of the past century led to at least 11,000 more houses being flooded by seawater from Florence's storm surge. So they just added 30 centimetres, but, I suppose it's just, you have to have a science in that article. Because they had a picture here on the page and they want to improve it. Sharp rise in the over 50s loneliness. The charity Age UK has warned that the number of older people who are alone, lonely will increase around 50% in the next 7 years. Data from the English Longitudinal Study of Aging, a long-term project investigating economic, physical and mental well-being of over 50s, shows that 2 million people in this age group will live in social isolation from 2015 to 2016, up from 1.36 million from 2015 to 2016 over a 10-year rise. Predicted increases due to several factors, including people living longer, family members living further apart, and cuts to the social services. Loneliness has become a downward spiral. People who are lonely are more likely to experience poor mental and physical health, which can lead to a greater socialisation. Yeah, okay. The UK government has set up an £11 million fund to help connect people across the country. The National Health Service recommends older people keep in touch with the family and friends via email and video chat. So, I wonder what that $11 million fund is. Now, so often those funds are projected over the forward estimate for 10 years, right? And the money is counted several times. So it actually is not there. It's a pretty amazing thing to see. Okay, oh, this poor chap, he's got his urine bag off the side, so he mustn't be too well. This is a picture of someone learning to walk again. And this is the new story. Every day, visit the new scientist. Okay, oh, this is by Andy Coghlan. People with paralysis walk again. Spine and brain implants help paralysis in 3 patients, says Andy Coghlan. One woman and 2 men paralyzed from the waist down have become the first people to walk again through a new type of therapy. Doctors treated them with a mixture of electrical stimulation, spinal implants, plus grueling exercise regimes. Can I tell you, it is absolutely grueling. You could have a will of steel to do. Two were treated at the University of Louisville's Kentucky Spinal Cord Injury Research Center. Kelly Thomas from Florida was injured in a 2014 car accident, while Jeff Mackey of Wisconsin broke his back in 2011 when mountain biking. A third person, Jared Shinnock, was injured in a snowmobile accident in 2013. So these are all lifestyle, you know, lifestyle things. All three received similar treatment. Surgeons implanted a panel of electrodes on their back below the injury site, tuning it to feed brain signals from into the tissue of the spinal cord below the injury that has connections to the main leg muscles. In theory, the break of their spines ruptured direct links between their brains and nerves that controlled their leg muscles. But the researchers of both clinics believe the implants somehow bridged the gap. They think that some nerve connections that cross the gap might remain intact, but they are too weak on their own to carry the brain signals to the legs. By tuning the electrical signals from the implant through the trial and error, coupled with extensive physical exercises, the team were able to boost the signals from the brain enough to stimulate movement of the leg muscles. First, all the three men learned to stand on a treadmill. With the aid of physiotherapists who move their legs plus a support system holding their upper bodies, they began to exercise to step forward. They could only move with an electrical stimulator or switched on. Next, they progressed to walking across the floor with the help of front wheel walkers, see photo below, and sometimes also the assistant to guide their balance. At the Mayo Clinic, Shinnock walked 331 steps in a single session on the floor, covering 102 metres between 25 to 42, his speed rose from 5 to 20 centimetres a second. Well, that's, I can't say when I first came out, it was first, this is the sound, but I really couldn't put half a foot in front of the other. Even though it was only one patient, being able to regain intentional control and move 100 metres is incredibly significant, said Kitty Lee from the clinic. In Kentucky, the work at the team, co-led by Claudia Angeli, allowed Thomas to walk across the floor solely aided by a stimulator at the end of the treatment. During one session, Marquis managed to cover 362 metres aided by the stimulator, reaching a top speed of 19 centimetres a second. The procedure didn't get everyone walking. Two more people treated by Angeli and a team Kentucky learned to stand and sit independently but didn't progress to walking. It may be that certain individuals lack the weak residual spinal connections on which the treatment might depend. A second person midway through is being treated by the Mayo Clinic. The latest breakthrough coincides with an advance. Another team has enabled Ian Backert from a man from Idaho with quadriplegia to intentionally control his hand and fingers and manipulate objects. Using our system, Ian was able to quickly and accurately interact with objects he encounters in his daily life. This is Freeburg in the Battelle Memorial Institute at Ohio, and co-leader of the team that provided the treatment. I was going to say he won't be the Olympic fencing champion. A microchip implanted in Battelle's motor cortex, the brain area that controls voluntary movement, feeds electrical signals to 96 locations in a device called the decoder. Machine learning algorithms then interpret the electrical activity as he thinks about moving his hand and predicts Bernard's intentions. Well, really, yeah, at a certain point, would you need a robot prosthetics to do it? Okay. Finally, an implant on his right forearm receives signals from the decoder as he's thinking. It is programmed to stimulate muscles in his forearm to carry out his intended actions. Well, it's sort of almost, I don't know, it's just the amount of effort to do these things is pretty amazing. And it's interesting about the Riemann hypothesis. I wonder if they actually give some interest. Now, this is an article by Chelsea White. Females rule just 7 mammal species. Females are rarely leaders of the pack in the animal kingdom. Of the 76 non-human mammal species that exhibit leadership, only 7 females take charge during conflict, foraging, or travel. It's only 76 leaders. That is the conclusion of a study into female leadership among mammals carried out by Jennifer Smith at the Mills College in California and her colleagues. Now, are these seven species fit a certain definition of leadership? Smith's team found that they have one or more of the following traits. They are physically stronger than males. They are long-lived and spend most of their life in one area, and they form social bonds with other females. Their work will appear in the leadership quarterly. In these species, females are bonded to each other, and they influence their society structures through directing food collection, fighting wars, deciding where the group moves, and holding local knowledge useful for finding food, says Smith. Here's a list of her team came up with: the African lion. Although known as the king of the jungle, the African lion forms a female-led pride. Lionesses stay in the area in which they are born their whole lives, which gives them the advantage of knowing where to find the best watering holes and hunting grounds. Females also cooperate on hunts, defend their territory from other prides, and defend cubs against adult males. Spotted hyena. Elsewhere on the African savanna, female spotted hyenas dominate clans. They are physically larger than the males and in command during conflict and predators or other clans. Quote, it's the adult females who are on the front lines in the battle, says Smith. The African elephant. Leadership is not always about aggression. African elephants live long lives. The matriarchs survive across many generations. This gives them more experience to draw on, which may influence their ability to lead the herd and food sources. They've got memory and mourning and all this type of stuff. And I think, what is it? Elephants masturbate. God. Only one of the species lives in the oceans. Well, out of seven, that's good. Female orcas live to their 90s and remain in their birth area throughout their lives, so the pod matriarch is a valuable knowledge of the location of salmon-filled waters. Yum. Lemurs. Two species of lemurs are female-led. In both ring-tailed and black and white ruffled lemurs, females often keep peace within the colony and lead the interventions with other colonies. Adult females, which are similar size to males, will consistently win a one-to-one confrontation with males. Bonobo. So let's see. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, 6. They put a double for the lemurs. Okay. Bonobo. One of our closest relatives. Females are help resolve group conflicts. They diffuse tension by using their hands or feet to touch an agitated individual's genitals. Smith's team says, this may give the impression that females bonobos lead through affection rather than aggression. The rest is a bit more nuanced, says Amy Parrish of the University of Southern California. I'm just checking. Oh, it's in California, so we just know more. She says bonobos, females can hurt males severely to keep control. Oh, yes, of course. A few other animals may join these seven as we study behaviour more closely. For instance, Smith and her friend's team says the naked mole rat colonies are known to be controlled by queens. She and her female relatives may hold sway over the colony, but at the moment we lack enough data on the role of females to play in conflict resolution to formally define this as the member species which are female-led. Look, I would say there's some bird species out there as well. Would be my... Oh, hello, birds. Oh, yeah, there's mammal species I only took. These birds are going to attack me. Lettuce planter hunter spies. It's the first few worlds. So they put out this new plant hunter. I think it's called TESS. It's just a very high-resolution telescope. Camera. Broad field. I think gigapixel camera. Let's see if it is the TESS. And who's written this article? Walter Gator and Lee Crane. NASA's new planet-hunting spacecraft has made its first find, an exoplanet about twice the size of Earth orbiting a star called Pi Mansi about 60 light-years away. The discovery comes 2 months after the transiting exoplanet survey satellite, TESS, began examining our galaxy with the aim of finding thousands of new worlds. Quote, this is one of the first objects we looked at, says Chelsea Huang, a test scientist at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We were immediately saying, hey, this is too good to be true. The alien world, Pi Mersis C, that orbits, that takes 3.27 days to orbit Earth, to orbit's parent star, which was previously found to have a planet of a mass of 10 Jupiters circling it. Tess works by watching thousands of nearby stars in the Milky Way, looking for tiny dips in their brightness that can indicate an orbiting planet is passing in front of them. And by having this for Pi Mersis C, the team confirmed the presence by examining separate studies of light of the star made of the background base by ground-based observatories. This revealed a tiny telltale wobble in the motion of the star, which is separate. that researchers attribute to the gravitational pull of Pi Mersis C. Based on the planet's radius, Pi Mersis C is likely to be a miniature Neptune with a gaseous hydrogen helium atmosphere. What? Twice the size of Earth, a miniature Neptune. That's a bit of a... Well, usually based on the density, wouldn't be. Let's read that. Based on the planet's radius and density, the radius but low density, it would be, this is high observable basalt, so it would be on the radius, therefore its density, radius and mass. Pretty much all the planets we find at that radius have a gassy layer, so it wouldn't look anything like Earth. So we've got almost no gassy layer. We're almost a sub-rock. We've only got 100 kilometers of atmosphere, which is nothing, nothing. That's something on the order of 2% of our radius is gas. You know, that's really nothing. So shortly after the first detection, NASA announced that TESS had found a second planet, LHS 3844b, which is orbits a similar star 49 light years away. It's smaller than Pi Mesa, only 1.3 times the size of Earth, but hotter than the average temperature of around 53 of about 532 degrees Celsius. Just about 2 Celsius. I wonder why they only didn't do the actual 5 decimal points there. Flying drones using mind control. Oh, let's mix anything, AI, mind control, drones, all that type of stuff. That's okay, and this one's by Chelsea White. I think before I fly, headsets that read brainwaves are being used to control drones, letting us fly machines with just our thoughts. A team of the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore trained 14 people to operate a multi-rotor drone using EEG headset devices, which use small electrodes to measure the electrical activity of your brain. There have been other major attempts to control motor rotor drones using thought, but Subhan Okma, who led the research, believes the new system is accurate enough to operate fixed-wing drones, something that has never been done before. So let me see. Oh, he only believes it. I wish I could get edited for my beliefs. Such aircraft require more control because they move through the air continuously, whereas multi-copter drones hover, for instance, while waiting a command. Other systems can translate brain activity into drone motion and cannot perform quickly enough to control high-speed vehicles, says Otmar. To pilot the drones, people were asked to imagine and not carry out 4 physical actions, moving their left or right hand, moving their left or right fingers and elbow. These processes activate sensory and motor cortex even without moving the body parts. Each was tried to a particular drone action. Algorithm read the brain waves at 90 Hz. This corresponds to the frequency of gamma waves, which are thought to be associated with the perception. When a thought pattern was clear enough, it was used to steer the drone in midair. Depending on the pilot, the algorithm interpreted instructions from the brainwave with an accuracy between 77% and 98%. The accuracy is partly thanks to developments in AI that are having an impact on the ability to interpret brain signals. Just... Look, I really wonder whether these people understand what... AI is. Everyone's just using AI. Higgledy piggledy. As the Riemann hypothesis been solved? So the Riemann hypothesis is something about the frequency of primes. I should have a look at it. It's 1 on 1 minus something or other, log something or other. This goes up. I think it's accuracy. Okay, let's see if they mention that at all. I find it really difficult when people have books, articles, and they don't mention the key mathematics, or I've read entire books where they have not actually understood the key science of what's going on. I'm an old man. Gilhead Amit is wrote this one. Has the Riemann hypothesis been solved? Question mark. Mathematicians held their breath this week to find out if one of the most famous unsolved problems in the field was finally cracked. In a hotly anticipated talk, Heidelberg Laureate Forum in Germany, retired mathematician Michael Atiyah delivered his claimed proof of the Riemann hypothesis, a challenge that has eluded his peers for nearly 160 years. Quote, solve the Riemann hypothesis and you become famous. If you're famous already, you become infamous. Atiyah said in the talk, nobody believes any proof of the Riemann hypothesis because it's so difficult. Nobody has proof of it, so why should anyone prove it now? Unless, of course, you have a totally new idea. The Riemann hypothesis is intimately connected to the distribution of prime numbers. There you go. What is a prediction? What? It is a prediction about the frequency of prime numbers. They define, or if you didn't know what prime numbers, those are divisible by any whole number other than themselves and one. And indivisible. If the hypothesis is proven to be correct, mathematicians will be armed with a map of the location of all prime numbers, a breakthrough with far-reaching repercussions in their field. No, it would be more the fact of be asking why. It's sort of like, this is like spooky maths is its most spookiness. In more practical terms, the correct solution earns its composer a $1 million prize from the Clay Mathematical Institute, which includes the hypothesis among the 6 unsolved Clay Millennium Problems. The prestige has tempted many mathematicians over the years, none of whom have yet been awarded the prize. Atiyah himself described simple proof builds on the work of 2 of the leading century figures, John von Neumann and Friedrich Hirzebruch. By combining their insights and assuming the Riemann hypothesis does not hold, Atiyah came to have reached a logical contradiction, implying the hypothesis must be correct. So, like, this is negative thing. It looks like Chris said, Atiyah, but I claim that all the hard work was done over 70 years ago. In his talk, Atiyah gave a history of his work, along with that of other noted mathematicians. His proof of the Riemann hypothesis was dealt with just a few decades, just a few slides. It claimed a connection with the fine structure constant. So, fine constant is this number. I think it's 1 on 137, and it comes from the electric charge, a whole series of things going up. Oh, that makes me almost sick. Because this is, like, if that's true, we're living in a really weird universe. Like, the Riemann hypothesis is just when you thought maths was boring. This is sort of, you know, like, here's these, you know, prime numbers that are just so difficult to find, and the fact that they fall into a distribution is just mind-blowing. And again, the fine structure constant is something which really gives me the shivers. Okay. A physical parameter that describes interaction between light and matter, and those whose status as constant has become into question. I don't think people have come to... No. What makes me upset by this is that one's deep in mathematics, which, and the other one's a physical thing. So if it is, I think it's just, if it is, it's true. Born in 1929, Atay is one of the UK's most eminent mathematicians, having received both awards often referred to as the Nobel Prizes of Maths, the Fields Medal Prize and the Abel Prize. He's also been president of the London Mathematical Society and the Royal Society of Edinburgh. That would really make me, if this is true, I'm feeling a bit sick. Atay has produced a number of papers in recent years making remarkable claims. Oh dear. That's code for makeable claims. So far, these have failed to convince others. So that's brief. Has yet to undergo rigorous peer review process necessary to test the validity, and initial reactions were cautiously sceptical. Mathematicians contacted by New Scientist declined to comment on this work. I think he's... The Room Hypothesis is a notoriously difficult problem for statistics of Warwick University, UK. Quote, lots of other top-rated mathematicians have nearly, but not quite, managed to prove it over the years, only for a subtle flaw in the proof to become apparent. If it's borne out, however, Atay hopes that his proof will inspire a younger generation to extend his work to more general cases of the Riemann hypothesis. What is a more general case of a Riemann hypothesis, as well as seemingly unrelated areas of mathematics? Hopefully, some useful insights will come out of Atay's work, even if the Riemann hypothesis proof doesn't quite hold together, says Jackson. I think writing it to the finite structure constant that's just really upsetting to read that, quite honestly. So, yeah, when you're in the field, things can upset you. Is this CRISPR again? Gene talk will help the spread of malaria, so this probably CRISPR and a gene drive. Let's see. Buckle the page. Millions live, it's malaria. There's a big picture of an insect, of a mosquito with its, just looking at it, I don't think it is a mosquito. Well, there's a picture of an insect. It says here, gene drives aim to cause mosquito populations to crash. The only thing is that it doesn't look like a mosquito's, sucking device coming out of it. So I suppose it is a mosquito. It's not one that I recognize. The mosquito species that I recognize. It's really interesting. There we've got a little, the drill is actually a little sort of extended jaws that go in, bite a little bit and secrete. Okay, millions of people, lives might be saved or transformed for the better by the first working gene drive. This piece of parasitic DNA could spread through the mosquito populations, wiping them out, making them infertile and halting the spread of deadly malaria. I think you actually have to put a few more logical steps in there, that malaria is a parasite borne by mosquitoes, certain species of mosquitoes. In the lab, the gene drive killed off all the mosquitoes within 12 generations. Quote, there's no progeny, says Andrea Castrini of Imperial College London, whose team gene drive is based on CRISPR. So, something like closely... interspaced palindromic repeat. Clustered regions of interspaced palindromic repeats. Gene editing tool method. There are 200 million cases of malaria each year and 500,000 deaths. Those who survive may have lasting health issues and become trapped in a cycle of illness and poverty. Quote, gene editing holds the potential to save millions of lives and empower millions of people to lift them out of poverty. I was going to say that sounds like complete, but it says by billionaire Bill Gates, whose charity is helping fund the work, wrote early this year. He wrote it. Gene drives are pieces of parasitic DNA inserted in one of the organ's chromosomes. Chromosomes generally come in pairs, sometimes in fives if you're aware of it, none of which is only one of which is passed from a parent to its offspring. Well, I think it's poorly expressed. There's one from each parent. So, such a piece of DNA would usually pass to half the animal's progenies. No. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. So the parent passes a combination of a synthesis of the two genes of its two parents. I think that this is where I find it so difficult. You teach this and you have this as an article. So the father synthesizes its the grandfather and grandmother and passes it through. So what you do is that you get any gene fragment comes from the grandmother and grandfather. It's either, and what is a synthesis, and from the mother comes from its maternal grandmother and grandfather. It's a little bit more complicated. I just find this, Michael and Page, this is really sad that you've missed this one. But gene drafts copy and paste themselves on to both chromosomes when the eggs and sperm form. Yeah, when eggs and sperm form, that's not correct. The eggs, no, it's not when they form, it's when they, Okay, I'll give you that one when it's formed, meaning they get passed on to all offspring and spread through the population. Until now, all gene drives tested in the labs have stopped spreading after a few generations. This is because they copy themselves a specific target site, and if the site mutates, they stop working. To avoid this kind of resistance, Cristini's team, that's an interesting thing, Cristini's team targeted a sequence crucial for the development of female mosquitoes that cannot mutate. Now this is interesting. So this is an example of mutation is actually probably a defense against natural gene drives. Isn't that incredible? Okay. The females have two copies of the gene drive, develop male genitalia and are infertile. You know what? I think oh yeah, okay. But males carrying two copies and females with just one look and behave normally, so the gene drive spreads rapidly. Eventually all females inherit two copies and the population crashes. Cassini's team found no signs of resistance evolving in their tests, which involved two cages of starting with 600 mosquitoes. To find out if the drive will work in the wild, the team will now carry out tests in bigger cages designed to mimic conditions in the tropics. The work will follow guidelines set up by the US National Academies of Sciences 2016. Even if the mosquitoes escape, they cannot survive in the region or interbreed with local mosquito species, Christine says. Because the gene drive could spread into many countries, all would have to give the go-ahead for the field tests to begin. For the scourge of malaria, a diplomatic agreement among all affected countries is feasible. Kevin Effsett of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a leading gene drive researcher, told The New Scientist recently. However, Effsett is opposed to releasing this kind of gene drive for the purpose other than eliminating diseases. The risk of a gene drive spreading or being smuggled into other areas is too great he warned last year. So I don't think it just has to be any, it just not has to be the seed line, it has to be, I think the CRISPR doesn't wait around and just only, so you actually put the genetic code for a CRISPR kit inside the cell. This is the important thing. So the gene drives by, give a CRISPR kit allowing you to cut and splice this set of genetic code into the gene, which means that this, so what it does is it is a gene drive is something where you mutate a gene such that it produces a genetic mutation kit. Well, I think I could say it a lot easier that way. So CRISPR is a DNA genetic editing kit, and you can actually get the gene, the cell to build its genetic editing kit, and therefore it put, and which puts a copy of itself in there. It's sort of like a box within a box. It's much easier. There's going to be a much easier way of saying it. It's a, also very interesting to look at this particular mosquito. So let's do CRISPR again. CRISPR is the Cas9 and the guide RNA to, so you need the Cas9 enzyme to produce, so you need to copy it in, and you need to get the Cas9 to go across and get the guide RNA to cut itself. So what it does is it cuts itself and then interspaces the gene editing kit into the new gene, so you can actually get it to operate like this. Okay. I'm sure I can get a better way of describing it. Stopping AI from falling for visual tricks. On the whole, humans don't have a problem telling a milk jug and a train about an orange, but the same doesn't apply to artificial intelligence, which can be fooled just by alternating a few pixels in an image. Yet, a new experiment hints that the difference between human and machine ships and might not be as big as we thought. I don't think AI has perceptions, but this is my own view. This could change the way we think about both human and computer vision and suggest the new ways to prevent AIs from getting quite so flummoxed. Zeglong Zhu and Cass Firestone of Johns Hopkins University showed people a range of different images that trip up AIs. The participants had to guess what the AI would incorrectly see from a list of 48 objects. The images ranged from those that tricked the AI into misidentifying a clearly depicted object, such as labeling orange as a power drill, to those where it would be identify objects that were not there, such as labeling a square of random pixels as an armadillo. Across six different kinds of image, most participants between 91% and 98%, depending on the image type, made more correct predictions than an AI would be expected by chance. It suggests that humans are able to decipher these images in the same way as the poor victim machines do, says R. Nugan of Auburn University in Alabama, who provided some of the examples for this experiment. Nugan thinks that this shows humans could help AI handle images better. One option would be to train AI to mimic human visual perception and use this model as a defense. Filtering out any guesses AI makes that don't agree with that of the human sees, he says. I think this is really weird. It's a huge research problem to defend against this type of visual trick for AI, said Firestone. Quote, it tickles me a bit to think humans could be part of the answer. Yeah, look, I must admit, clearly you have to, I wish people, it's, you know, when they get onto a dud story like that Riemann proof, they've almost got an ethical problem. They want to sell the magazine, they want to fill it up, but they've got an ethical problem to be quite correct.
Okay.
54, reading on. Conflicts contradicts itself. Okay. Okay. Anil Anthawasamy is the author. Quantum mechanics seems to falter when applied to large objects like people, suggesting it may not be a valid description of how nature works at levels beyond the microscopic. Wow, I must admit, that's just bluff. That's just ridiculous. What, it seems to falter when applied to large scale objects like people? What? Ah, it's just ridiculous. That's just insulting. Quantum mechanics seems to falter when applied to large scale objects like people. What? Suggesting it may not be a valid description of how nature works at levels beyond the microscopic. Oh, God, this is complete garth. Okay. Standard quantum mechanical theory explains the behavior of tiny things like electrons and atoms. In practice, it is very difficult to observe quantum behavior in large objects. But in principle, the theory should still apply, and it should be possible to do this. However, the universal applicability of quantum theory at all scales is an assumption that may not be correct. Just this, Daniel Freudinger and Ronaldo Reno of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich came up with an elaborate thought experiment. Well, this is worthwhile. It begins with a person, say, Amy, tossing a coin and using, this to set the property called spin on a particle. Which is the standard thing. What you do is, I think you get a laser and you go sufficiently short pulse that the spin is random. Okay. To set the spin. Amy's tossing a coin using a result to set the property called spin of a particle. Heads. And so the spin is set down, tails the spin is set up. Amy sends the particle to Brian, who measures the spin. He finds it to be up. He knows Amy got tails, otherwise she got heads. I think this is absolutely mad. He's got the entire Poincaré sphere. Okay, I will have to re-study this. I think the issue is that, he can get information, but he has to decode it. He has to actually get Amy still has to send him some information. I have to this is the Bell hypothesis, so I think this is really wild. I have to really, really remember what's going on. So you get a laser, you put it through a doubling crystal, and so the double crystal produces two entangled photons, and but if you have a polarized laser, you only get two beams. So if you have a continuous laser, this is actually how you actually build it in the lab. If you have a continuous laser going through a doubling crystal, you get two spins both up, so you have to chop it, and when you have a sufficiently short pulse going in, spin becomes random, so you've got two entangled photons. Now you can decide to measure on the Poincaré sphere equatorial or polar, i.e. whether it's linear or circularly polarized, and it means that the other person will either get will be able to detect randomly, he'll get a random set of numbers, and he will not be able to tell the experiment that you've done. The other person will not be able to, but you will be able to send information for him to decode what you've said. So it actually doesn't break any laws of physics, except there's something really on the edge that you can send ultra compressed information to him, because you have to compress the information of your random choice. You have to send him the, like you can do a pseudo random stuff, but you've got to send the key to him. Okay, let's go. So this really does require a lot of understanding. Meanwhile, Andy has a friend, Andy, who uses quantum theory to model Amy and her entire lab, which is the correct thing to do. All of these paradoxes go away. If you have a classical device generating a quantum field, and it's measured with a classical device, you get these contradictions. But if you have quantum, it all irons out. Okay. Andy checks whether Amy and her lab is in the quantum supposition of two states. The result is yes or no answer. Brian is a friend of Bella, who applies quantum theory to Brian in his lab in just the same way. The quantum theory says, who are these people again? Daniela and Renato Reina's great top physicist for sure. Quantum theory says the particle spin as measured by Brian is linked or correlated to the outcome of Andy's coin toss. That means Andy gets a yes for the experiment of the coin toss experiment. He can make a definite statement about the spin of the particle Brian saw. But if Bella gets a yes for her measurements and Brian is and his lab for the experiment, she could say something definitive about whether Amy saw heads or tails. Dear. This is the whole thing. A lot of people have really not understood this and have talking about weird, spooky action at a distance and quantum entanglement faster than speed of light communication. It's all guff. It is really interesting, like the Feynman structure constant. It's sort of just achingly complete theory. Okay. But the math of quantum theory shows that in a small minority of cases, this thought experiment produces contradictions. Andy gets a yes, and now Brian, Andy can get a yes and know that Brian saw the particle with the spin down, and at the same time Bella can get a yes and know that Amy saw the scorn, the spin that came up tails. The facts don't match, and they should if quantum theory holds at larger scales. This analysis assumed is equally valid for Amy to describe her experiment using quantum theory as it is for Andy to describe Andy's and her entire lab that way, so for Brian and Bella. Rand thinks this assumption that quantum theory is universal is suspect. Why should the same theory still work on the scale of humans? Oh, God, he says. It could well be there's some modification. No. The thought experiment is very provocative, says Robert Speak in the Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics of Ontario, Canada. This is sort of like the most doublespeak. There's been a long tradition in the field of foundational quantum mechanics to talk about quantum theory predicts about how one observer ought to describe another observer. He says, their contribution has really reinvigorated those discussions. He's not saying that, saying in the most humble way, my God, this is, they're just, okay. The earliest animal, this is just ridiculous, a ridiculous article. Okay. This is by Alice Klein, earliest animal identified by its face structure. And so this is, animals identified by, Twig. Is it Rex Twig? He's a geologist in South Australia. I knew his daughter, Reg Twig, a Mawson geologist. He found this. I wonder if they mention it. It's an Australian animal. It's been found everywhere in the world. These little fat, flat doormats. Okay, earliest animal identified by its fatty signature. That's right. They actually found this animal and did some tests on it and found that it had animal fats in it, so therefore it's an animal, not a plant. strange soft body creature that lived half a billion years ago, which is, that's it. That's, we have, all life began half a billion years ago, but I think it didn't actually, 500 million years ago, it's where I think dinosaurs and fish came about 350 million years ago, you got the Cranium explosion and stuff like that. And that Jura region, it's in Switzerland. Okay, I just remembered all of that. A strange soft-bodied sea creature that lived over half a billion years ago may be the first animal species on Earth. The earliest large complex organisms known as Ednacarians appeared in the fossil record about 570 million years ago. Was it? Yeah, that's correct. 570, I think we had sex and vision 500 million, so it took 70 million years to go from a large animal to something animal with vision and sex. Just before the dramatic rise in the animal diversity known as the Cambrian explosion. The alien body shapes a great confusion over whether they were primitive animals or complex life forms like lichen or giant amoebas or failed experiments in evolution. Now, Joachim Brox of the Australian National University and his colleagues have found fats in 158 million year old fossils of Dickinsonia, a type of Dickarina, that seem to confirm it was an early animal. The researchers found sandstone cliffs in the White Sea region in Russia. Cholesterol-like molecules preserved in them are found most animals today. Almost all animals, while non-animals, life forms such, have much less of these substances. These presence of fossils implied that Sonia was rich in these fats. It tells us the creature was in fact our earliest ancestor, says Brock. Like animals, like today's animals, Sonia was probably used cholesterol to build cell walls. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that you built cell walls on cholesterol. So it's your lipid layer. I wonder what cholesterol is. Have a look at it. Cholesterol's discovery is the best evidence yet of Dickinsonia was an animal. It says Emil Mitchell of the University of Cambridge, but other species may have preceded it in the animal line, she said. Well, it's pretty early, and it's pretty much basically a slab of meat. So it must have, moved. I think that's a fundamental thing of animals. Although you've got polyps, which are animals, which don't move. All they move, so move. They're locked and moved. Okay. Okay, that finishes. That's an hour and 7 minutes. I'll go back in and see if everything's there. News and technology. I'll get through this pretty quickly. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.